The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. You're hearing strange questions in this space age, like, who was Christ, or is God dead? And you hear of challenges, too, when an accident occurs and a child dies. Theologians are challenged and asked to answer the most difficult question of all to them. Why did God allow the death of a child? Or what about blindness, deafness, sickness, disease? Challenging television interviews are given sometimes, and the public is made aware of some of the embarrassing questions being asked leading theologians. Most of them say, well, the answer is faith, that you've got to have a personal experience, or you must just believe that God is, and believe the Bible is true, and believe various things. Well, you know, on the other hand, there are evolutionists which say they believe that such and such occurred. And they have quite an astounding faith when you look at their faith. Now, I don't know if an evolutionist has ever had a personal experience with evolution, but I do believe that many of them believe evolution. And it appears to them to be true. You know, it's amazing how many theologians are backed into the corner by a question such as, why did God allow the death of my little brother? Why blindness, deafness, dumbness? Why do the innocent and the children suffer in war? Why all the poverty? Why the malnutrition? And why all of the financial and economic calamity in the world today? Why natural calamities that come along and take away people's farms, homes? Why tornadoes, hurricanes? And the average minister says, you know, these are the most difficult questions for us to ask. And I think, well, of all things, why is that? And the answer is given so plainly in Scripture time and time again. It seems many theologians are assuming that the Bible says God Almighty is trying his very frantic level best to keep you from having an accident. That God Almighty is trying his very level best to prevent the death of every child and to prevent wars and to bring the world peace. And I have to shake my head and think, well, of all the ghastly mistakes, what on earth ever led any person who ever remotely looked into the Bible to believe a thing as futile and weird as that is? To think that God is trying to save the world. It's one of the dumbest things you've ever thought of. Now, does that shock you? Well, I'm sorry. I want to talk to you about a notion you've had. You've had a notion in your head about the Bible, just like a lot of people have a certain notion about evolution. But you may not have compared that notion with fact, and so you might think that God's trying to save the world. Now, let's admit one thing, shall we? All together now, let's say it together. The world is not saved. True or untrue? Fact or fiction? There are more people, and by any way you want to reckon it, whether you use evangelistic terminology or spiritual language and talk about a saving experience, and whether you even remotely know the word salvation or whether you're sitting on a bar stool at the moment hearing it on your transistor radio makes no difference to me one way or the other. I don't care what language you use, whether you just say church, unchurched, churchgoers, people with a private religious philosophy, people with their personal faith, or whether you say people who have been saved. You will have to admit there are more people in a so-called unsaved category today, proportionate to the population, than there has ever been at any other time in all the history of mankind, as surprising as that sounds. So it's about time you took a look at the Bible and see, is Scripture valid? Is the Bible myth or authority? Now, certainly, people wonder, we can forget about the Bible in a time such as this. Besides, hasn't evolution proved that the Bible is not true after all? Well, you know, there's a sort of a vague, poorly thought-out notion in your head when you start to think about evolution. Oh, there it is, if you take a look at it closely. You see a pronouncement of science that talks about a sort of a half-lizard, half-bird with feathers long ago, and you sort of immediately suppose, well, yeah, I suppose if you give it a few billion years that there could have been sort of a change, and then you go, and the next thought is something else entirely different. So far as coming to grips with a few embarrassing questions and looking really closely at such things with a true scientific perspective, well, you probably just never have. And most paleontologists never have, and most evolutionists never have. Because you've never known a paleontologist yet who went to college learning to challenge the textbook and find out what's wrong with the evolutionary theory. He was going to get a degree and to write his own textbook and to become a man of stature and status in the evolutionary field to take up where others have left off in educating our youth today to believe in evolution. Now, when you do look closely in a true scientific perspective, you will see only fully developed species, admirably equipped for survival in their present habitat. You never run across half a leg, or half an arm, or part of a feather, or a partially developed beak, or an egg that isn't quite solid as a shell for a covering. You don't see anything that is sort of halfway developed, like part of an eye or part of an ear in nature. Whenever you look in nature, whether it's a wing, a leaf, anything you look at, the closer you look, the more perfection, the more intricacy, and the more amazing it becomes. Whenever you look at something that man has done, the closer you look under a microscope, the more imperfection you see. Now, you may have supposed in your mind that evolution is true. You might have that notion. And you may be a sort of a religious person that goes to a church, or at least has a faith of some sort, a religious philosophy. But in your life, you have heard, or you've read, or you've seen pictures portraying these vast and awesome changes that should have occurred in the evolutionary series. Usually, it's been a person with a degree who's been talking, some person who is always noted, or respected, or famous in his field. Or you've seen a colorful prelude to a Walt Disney film about nature. Or you've seen the opening chapter of a history or a geography book, or you've read an article in National Geographic, or a column in a newspaper written by the science editor. And probably you've never attempted to challenge your belief in evolution by comparing it with known scientific factors and asking some embarrassing questions. Now, people enjoy asking what they feel are embarrassing questions of theologians. They enjoy asking a theologian, why did my child die? Why can't you explain deafness, blindness? Why can't you explain chance? Why can't you explain wars, they say to leading theologians. And the theologians say, well, I've got to fall back on faith. Not me. Not me. I don't have to fall back just on faith. I have faith, all right, but I have faith based upon evidence. Because faith is the evidence of things that are invisible and not seen. And there is visible and tangible proof for that which is not seen. And the Bible itself challenges you to take that which is known and that which is measurable and ascertainable by physical, material, scientific research, measurement, and weight, by the observation of man's own mind, by the tools at his disposal, and to prove the spiritual and that which you cannot see by applying physical and material laws and physical material questions concerning nature, concerning that which has been made. That's in the first chapter of the book of Romans, that you can prove the invisible things of the very Godhead, the God family, by those things which have been made. So let's sort of turn the tables and let's ask a few embarrassing questions of evolutionists. Why can't they prove a few things for a change instead of expecting all of their adherents and followers to swallow the biggest single lump of foo-for-all, of vanity, of dumb idiocy, of hypocrisy, of half-truths, and of backward, upside-down, twisted facts, of quietly altered facts, of facts glossed over or disposed of, facts which are kept hidden, other facts which are not admitted? It's the biggest hodgepodge of error and assumption you have ever seen in your life, if you have seen it. I mean, if you have looked at it. Now, probably, you've never attempted to challenge your faith, whatever it might be, whether a personal philosophy or a definite religious idea, your religious faith, by comparing it with evolution. Neither have you challenged evolution by comparing it with your religious faith, because you probably are a little worried about the outcome. Conversely, neither have most professing Christians ever challenged their Christian faith by comparing that with the Bible. There are just a whole lot of comparisons that have never occurred yet. You may never have held up your faith, your personal philosophy, to the exact light of the Bible and found out how that squares. But neither have many people who might be church-going people one day of the week, and very hard-thinking, fast-talking, business-like people with an evolutionary concept behind everything they say, think, and do the rest of the week. They may be church-going people, but still there is this nagging din in the back of their head that evolution is probably true. They've never faced square to the question, yes, but if evolution is true, then my religion can't be true. They've just never compared the two. Millions of professing Christians, therefore, treat the Bible and evolution just alike. They're afraid of both. They're afraid if evolution is true, the Bible can't be. They're afraid if the Bible is true, evolution can't be. And evolution seems to say the Bible couldn't be true, and if evolution is true, the miracles of the Bible, the story of the Bible, the history of the Bible, the claims about creation, the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, Daniel, Noah, Jonah, Elijah, even the birth, resurrection of Christ, those couldn't be true either. Now, they haven't studied evolution. They have not studied comparative embryology or paleontology. They have not studied very much biology or anatomy or physiology or zoology or microbiology. They just have not. I mean, the average layman has not even remotely been introduced to some of these studies. Neither, and in exact proportion, has the average church-going professing Christian studied very much at all about the Bible upon which he bases his religious philosophies. So you have to say we're sort of starting even. The average layman knows little, if anything, about evolution, and knows little, if anything, and maybe even less, about the Bible. But, you know, most people haven't compared the two because it's such a challenge it would unsettle or disturb their common everyday lives. It would make them think along unfamiliar lines, and that is bothersome to most people. They're afraid that evolution might have some pretty tangible proofs to present, and so they sort of speculate, but they keep their minds uninvolved. They see this proverbial statement in the newspaper in the lower right-hand column about a man discovering some bones in Africa or South America or in Java or somewhere else, and it pushes the known, perhaps, history of man back a few hundred thousand or a few million years, give or take a few million here or there, and they sort of look at it vaguely, and then they read the article about the latest murders and the latest divorce and about where Jacqueline Kennedy is at the moment and what happened to Princess Grace, and they read the rest of the news about the Gemini Project, or they read about the weather, and they want to check on the sports to find out where the Dodgers are, or maybe the Liverpool soccer scores and the homecoming when the pop bottles get thrown at policemen's craniums. Or if you're in Johannesburg, you want to read about the latest record of the Springboks and see how they're doing. But you keep your mind uninvolved. Your mind is like a vast DEW line. I want to explain to you about your mind. You've got a marvelous mechanism there. You know, your mind is just like a vast early warning mechanism, a radar system sprawling across northwestern United States. In fact, it fits into the same analogy or the same sort of a place as a giant computer would that is programmed to receive information through certain circuits and along certain predetermined lines. And your mind is going to receive certain trains of thought only if they are going to fit into the cells that are already programmed for them. Now, asking your mind to compare some of these religious philosophies with evolution to get to the very heart and the core of the most embarrassing questions to your religious philosophy as well as to the most embarrassing questions to evolution would be just like asking a computer, which, remember, only gives that back which you fed into it previously, for information it simply does not contain. It's like trying to feed into a computer that is all set up in a certain program, feeding into it electronic impulses through a totally different equipment along different lines through non-existent circuits which would only clog, jam, and throw the machine into a nightmarish confusion of electronic sparks, and there just wouldn't anything come out of it. You might wreck the whole machine. Now, your mind is equipped with a sort of an early warning set of gear. You ever watch somebody attending a lecture or a businessman's club or a social event or a church service like as not, when they obviously did not agree? They get this bored look and they get this thoughtful look. Time and again they've got their chin in the air, but it's always accompanied with a frown of the brow and a pucker of the lower lip, and they're looking about at the other guests. You notice they spend a lot of time looking at distant objects, noticing things around them, pulling at their chin, tugging at their ear, scratching their nose, looking as if with concentration about them, but not with an open-eyed look of concentration on what the teacher or the preacher or the spokesman or the lecturer or the reporter is giving them. Well, they obviously don't agree. It's as if they're engaged in a desperate battle to keep their minds absorbed on something else and to keep their minds from admitting a certain train of thought which is to them unsettling and dangerous and does not appeal to them. So their mind flashes in all directions, calling up instant objections, weird analyses, or just blank prejudice, primarily aimed at the person. They don't like his accent. They don't like his height. They don't like the way he put it. They think, who does he think he is? A lot of instant, ready-made objections and resentments are right there in your mind. It's the most dizzying collection of fantastic gear you've ever seen, and you've got a terrific resistance You refuse to think about the unthinkable. You don't want to imagine the unacceptable and the unimaginable. You will not ponder the imponderable because your mind doesn't want you to, and so you're not going to do it. You hear somebody tell you something that is unsettling to your faith, that is unsettling to your prejudices, your opinions, everything that you've taken into your mind, your way of life, the very programmed trains of thought that are comforting to you, and it, as they say in the modern vernacular, it bugs you. It makes you a little bit nettled, and so you simply will not think about it. And that's exactly why millions of professing Christians have never compared their faith, their personal philosophies, with the Bible. And it's exactly why millions of laymen in the world today have never compared the facts of nature with evolution. They feel that evolution has preponderance of education and educators of research, discovery, science, who is the modern God, incidentally, on the side of evolution. And they feel that on the religious side is not very much, only emotionalism, blind faith, tradition, fables, and maybe moral and social need to keep our children off the streets. Automatically, they begin to believe that maybe evolution has the weight of evidence on its side, and so they sort of just shelve the whole question and put it off. They avoid the issue. Well, let me tell you, you don't need to avoid the issue, and you don't need to be afraid of the outcome, because there's nothing to fear. Because your mind is going, after all, to admit into that mind only that which you want to admit. Oh, and true or untrue has nothing to do with it. Millions of people have said, in effect, don't confuse me with the facts. So if I'm leading you along a line of reasoning that is unfamiliar for the moment, don't worry about it. You're not going anywhere. Nobody is going to cause you to join something. You're only going to admit into your mind that which appeals to you anyhow. Now, I can prove certain things to you which may even be unappealing. It's all right, even though you might in one corner of your mind admit it's true. You'll reject it if you desire to reject it. So now let's dive in, and let's not worry about the outcome for the moment. You don't need to avoid the issues. You can absolutely disprove evolution. And you can scientifically prove there is a God, and that the Bible is His inspired word. I know that sounds out of date and pretentious today. You know, evolution turns to nature, and remember, it's only a theory, and it tries to explain nature, which is only a coined term that means nature, a word that, well, what does it mean? It means natural. It has to do with a prefix from the Greek that means birth, from which we take nativity, and in the Spanish, Navidad. It's a word that means present state, status quo. It means elements, energies, laws, forces, matter, and life itself. It means the present state of all that we can see or know in the tangible material world and all living matter. And they call it today blind nature. But there is nothing blind about nature, as you will see in this series of programs where I'm challenging evolution over and over again with the facts of nature and the facts of science and the facts that evolution itself does not like to admit. Blind nature, they call it. And yet, with all of our modern scientific knowledge, we have yet to understand nature. And we come up against this blank wall and the other one. We can tell you a little bit about this aspect of one bird or insect or plant or animal, and then we can't tell you what makes these creatures act the way they do. We can't tell you how they're guided, how they survive, the tremendous mathematicians in the universe, in nature that we know of, how they camouflage themselves, how they procreate, how they manage to commit mass suicide to perpetuate the species. Science remains absolutely baffled by much of nature, yet seeks to use nature, which is baffling by itself, and so-called natural causes to explain theories on how all this vast, complex nature could come into existence by itself. Talk about reasoning in a circle. It's time you took a few examples, simple ones, and thought about them. And quit refusing to think. Really pondered. And it's quite simple. It would make good material for any beginning class in biology, ornithology, any of the studies of nature that we like to take a Greek word to describe. Now take birds, for instance. You know, from the time you were a little child, lying out in your front yard and listening to a bird in the morning and watching a little bird flitting around a tree, you've been fascinated by birds. I have. Everybody is. And as a little child, you probably wished you were one. Way, way back when men watched the birds, they hoped to someday fly. Today we have achieved that. And we find that you don't need to have any special shape for anything that gets out above air, that orbits around. It doesn't need to be designed aerodynamically, except as a heat shield when it comes back in so that its reentry can be controlled in proper attitude so as to preserve the lives of astronauts. From time immemorial, men have drawn pictures of birds. They've called themselves by the names of birds. They've written poetry, music, and all types of books and odes and stories about birds. And they have taken birds as the symbols of nations. And men have strapped wings on themselves and jumped off buildings and sometimes got a conk on the brain for their pains trying to fly like birds until finally men began to learn to fly and began to design wings just like birds. But now you look at birds and you find thousands and thousands of different types. All different types of beaks and different types of wings and eggs and nests, and all of them are different in flight. Birds do almost anything, it seems. There are soaring birds, there are diving birds, diving in the air, I mean. There are birds that bob around on the water and some that dive under rushing streams and others that swim in lakes. Shallow water and deep water birds, salt water and freshwater birds. There are birds that fly backward. There are birds that swim, soar, float, fly backwards, hover, some walk and can't fly. And every single one of these things, they say, evolved. Now, you take the emperor penguin, for example. Let's just ask another embarrassing question of evolution. Here's the emperor penguin, where the male has a sac, which is nothing more than a very deep, baggy sort of appendage of skin and fur and feathers on the lower part of his anatomy between his legs, into which the female deposits this huge egg. Now let's go back a few billion years to the first emperor penguins. And let's try to imagine, here's this dumb male standing there and he has no sac. Remember, because the sac had to be evolved, evolution tells you, through necessity to preserve this egg which kept freezing. Now the female tried, they couldn't talk, maybe they had penguin language, but what was it? A few squawks, maybe a whack with a beak or a flipper. And she tried to indicate, look, you clod, I keep laying these eggs, and you don't have any place to put them. Now, what did the penguin do? Squat on it? No, because the egg would have been frozen to the ice, because the heat of the body would have caused a little bit of melting around the area, and then through the night and so on, the bottom part of the egg would have frozen, and the egg will not survive. Now, mind you, any emperor penguin, if you take the egg out of the sack, it's going to die. It will not survive. So the very first egg had to be in that sack, but where did he get it? How about that? An instantaneous emperor penguin sac to hatch the egg. Now, we can keep imagining how this happened. We can think that maybe down through billions of years, your mind can kind of whirl, and again, this early warning network can come into play, and your mind can sort of real quickly imagine, throw in a few million years and sprinkle a lot of thoughts and concepts in, and think, well, it probably could have happened, and then go on and think about something else. But let's go back to that first pair of creatures. Now, where did they come from? Well, they were some other type of bird. But if they were some other type of bird, were they admirably suited to that environment? And were they getting along just fine as another kind of bird? Oh, yes. Well, then why did they evolve into emperor penguins? Why didn't they stay the way they were? Well, nature began to shift, they claim, and maybe climatic patterns began to change, and so they had to do this to survive. Oh, I see. Well, now wait just a minute. How did they manage to do that? You know, even among intelligent creatures, and the most intelligent of all, we think, is man, we cannot transmit desire to our children. It does not follow that the world's best surgeons will have surgeons as children who will be automatically equipped with medical knowledge. It does not follow that even though many a father hopes and prays that his son is going to follow in his footsteps, and while the father may have acquired certain knowledge to adapt to his environment in this dog-eat-dog culture, his boy isn't born with any special knowledge to adapt. His boy could be born along the Amazon River of some natives, and he'd grow up a savage. He'll grow up just exactly what his environment and his culture makes him. The evolutionist will hear about this point, dodge the issue by skipping adroitly behind a few billion years of supposed passing of time. He won't like to face this question. Well, let's let him dodge. The question is, how did the very first emperor penguin lay an egg into a sack which didn't yet exist? Now, they claim that's a sort of a evolutionary link because an emperor penguin has this very poorly developed wing and he can't fly. Oh, you talk about dumb. He doesn't need a wing. That's not a wing. It's a flipper or a fin, and it's the admirably suited fin for the best little diver and swimmer you ever saw that can swim a lot faster than all the fish that he feeds upon. And if he had a wing, it would become so waterlogged it would drown him. Now, of course, the first emperors probably, they figure, had wings, but they needed to develop flippers, did they? So they dove into this ice water, they promptly froze, became waterlogged, they all drowned, and none of them survived. Now, millions of years later, as the emperor was going along, but you see, that doesn't make sense, does it?
every one of the creatures in nature had to become completely and totally equipped with all his present, well, what would you say, survival gear, his procreative powers, his powers of obtaining of food and the building of a nest and the protection of his egg, whatever it is, whether it's a bird, insect, you name it, anything. And, of course, the emperor also had to have a complete digestive, skeletal, muscular system, had to be completely covered with feathers, which are not only tremendously cold-resistant, but also very much water-resistant, had to have all those oils. And, of course, inside his digestive system had to be millions and millions of microbes to help him digest his food. He had to have such tremendous, powerful digestive juices he could swallow bones whole, the entire skeletal structure of huge fish, and have the entire thing devoured and become absolutely nothing. Now, that was real nice that he was able to do that. It's fortunate, not that it makes any difference to your life. You don't eat emperor penguins very often, but at least they are there. The question is, how do they get there? Are these acquired characteristics or not? And if so, how come Hebrew babies aren't born circumcised? You know, you can begin to apply some very rational and coldly logical questions to evolution, and evolution begins to look a little bit embarrassed. Now, I've got thousands of them I'd like to talk to you about. Here's what, in one encyclopedia, science talks about birds when it goes clear back to the history of birds. It says, scientists believe that reptiles were the ancestors of birds. Birds have so many of the same characteristics as reptiles that they're sometimes called feathered reptiles. Isn't that interesting? You weren't looking at birds this morning, or yesterday, or the day before, but feathered reptiles. Scientists believe that feathers developed from the scales on reptiles. But, you know, if reptiles were doing just fine as reptiles and had no need to fly, and which reptile does, then how could they gradually develop feathers out of scales? You've never seen a partial scale and a partial feather, but a fully developed, intricately, unbelievably complex scale or complex feather, and nothing halfway between. Then it follows, scientists have traced the history of birds back to an animal called such and such that probably lived about 150 million years ago. Here's another word, probably. Feathers on the wings probably enabled this thing to glide through the air. Ornithologists believe the two other bird-like creatures lived and so on. And this is what you'll find in the encyclopedias on the subject, after which they tell you they don't know why ducks migrate. They can't explain the pattern of the Arctic tern. They do not know, and they're even still trying to make wild guesses as to how these birds are guided in flight from nesting grounds to their wintering grounds. Well, you need to write in for these booklets and solve a few of the questions yourself. I'll continue along this line next time and give you some of these amazing facts about birds and other creatures. But write for these booklets. Does God exist? One on the proof of the Bible and seven proofs God exists, and clear it up and find it proved for yourself. Seven proofs God exists. It's absolutely proved. Then write for this booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, what it will be like. It's filled with good news, but at least it acknowledges the way things are today first, but it gives you the final solution. It's free of charge. There's no price for it. The current number of the Plain Truth magazine with this article in Britain, Kosygin reveals Russia's real fear. Why celebrate Easter? An exciting preview of tomorrow's cities. And is Romania going to join the common market? They're free of charge and no price. The Plain Truth and the booklet by the title of this program, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Give us the call letters of your station, that's all. No cost, no request for money, and no follow-up. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.